You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 20th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post. Later in the better half of the show, guy Lee Stranahan, who's on my Twitter feed for a long time, just said too many annoying things, so I invited him on the show, the second half of the show, to just try and get into the mind of people who tweet stuff. Such glibness and confidence, and clearly have no idea what they're talking about. That'll be later in the program. Troy Davis still sentenced to death. I will get to that Monsanto story today. Don't ask, don't tell. Dead as of last night, I think at midnight. Couple other things of note. First off, congratulations. To Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks, the new 7 p.m. show on Current TV, just announced today. Maybe he will get his lighting equipment out of my office now. We'll see about that. Also, Elizabeth Warren, she jumped into the race, I guess officially a week or two ago. She's already leading now Scott Brown by a margin of 46 to 44, erasing what was a 15-point deficit as of June. She's gone from 38% name recognition to 62% over the last 3 months. And apparently, she's made a very good first impression. What was a 21 to 17 favorable to unfavorable is now 40 to 22. So she gained 19 favorability points relative to 5 unfavorably. That's stunning. Still a whiles off, but that is, I've never seen anything like that, frankly. So good for her. Folks, before we bring on Ryan Grimm, I've been chastised by our members for making a membership plea at the end of the program when most people probably have turned it off. So I want to make a plea for you to become a member of the Majority Report. It is less than 33 cents a day, $10 a month to both support the program, and as a bonus, you get an extra 50 minutes of programming every day, plus occasionally, you know, even another bonus interview or just other good things. So you get more of the show, and you also make sure that the show stays on. And you finance things like me going on Dylan Radigan's program to shoot down this libertarian who's got a problem with us supporting green technology. We'll talk more about that in the better half of the program. Also, you can support this show by going to donateyouraccount.com. /majority. You can support the show by buying your coffee, tea, or chocolate through justcoffee.coop. You can buy your Amazon crap through our link our Amazon link. Just click on our Amazon link, majority.fm, bookmark it, and then buy all your Amazon crap through there. We get a little bit of a kickback on that.
You can leave positive reviews on iTunes. And
Positive review on iTunes?
The podcast awards are accepting nominations, podcastawards.com. You can nominate us. I think we want to go for the politics slash news category. Yeah, put us in the politics.
Does that help if we get a if we win an award like that? Does that help?
People who are stumbling on that site because maybe a tech blog sent them. I mean, a tech podcast sent them, or some other a comedy podcast sent them.
And we get to put a little like badge on our page, right?
Yeah, and people will find out about the
what is it? Show? Podcast Awards.
Podcastawards.com. There's a form on the left-hand side, sort of at the bottom, is the news politics category. In the name, put Majority Report. In the URL, put majority.fm. And then just, I think you just have to put your name and your email. And
how about how about it, folks? I've never, ever won any award like that. Ever. I didn't even come close on the Emmys. I found out the Emmys already took place. I guess I didn't. Nobody called me. I must not have gotten nominated. Nothing happened. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm from HuffingtonPost.com. That's podcastawards.com. You can nominate the show for, what is it, News and Politics?
Yep, that's it.
News and Politics. Nominate us to win an award, I guess. Is there money involved in this?
Probably not.
All right, well, it's the thought that counts. We'll be right back. On the phone, want to welcome back to the program the Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. Ryan, welcome back to the program. Oh, hold on for 1 second. Sorry. Ryan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
All right, we have President Obama came out with his jobs plan last week on Monday, yesterday. He announced his deficit deal. Tell us, just break it down for us.
Sure. So the president wants to go for $3 trillion deficit reduction, which includes the cuts that have already been made, and split it between cuts and revenue increases, mostly taxes on the rich. A lot of his cuts come from just winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But another couple hundred billion come out of Medicare and Medicaid. So that's the part that has people worried. But the rest of it has Republicans saying, forget about it.
Right. Okay. Well, yes. Let's get to that shortly. But let's just break down these tax increases. Half of the $1.5 trillion in tax increases is essentially just allowing the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy to expire, correct?
Right. It's a really simple way to raise a ton of revenue for the government. Just go ahead and let those suckers expire. So, you know, this is often portrayed as if it's a complicated policy question, but it's really not, as he demonstrated by saying, just let these expire and we'll get to most of it.
Does that kick in? Do you know? When he says, you know, the Bush tax cuts were across the board, at what point does that, how does that break down? In other words, at what income level? Do you know?
Sure. He's saying that for 250, for married families, 250,000 above, or individuals making 200,000 or above, that would revert to the Clinton rates. Everybody else would get to keep their little Bush tax cut.
Okay, so that's the details of the program. And what do we know about the potential for Medicare and Medicaid cuts?
Given that what the president has said in the past about entitlements, both Social Security and Medicare, the fact that he only came out with this small amount of cuts is actually, you know, being really being welcomed by liberals, because for years he's just been throwing around rhetoric that made you think that he really wants to take a knife to some of these programs. He had talked in the past about raising the eligibility age for Medicare, about indexing the way that Social Security payments are doled out, so that old folks would get less each month. And what he came back with isn't that big a deal compared to what he's been talking about in the past, though it's not trivial. He finds a lot of savings in, you know, basically so-called waste, fraud, and abuse, which means that it's not really much of a serious attempt to cut. But
why don't
they
call
that
the Rick Scott provision? Wouldn't that be good politics?
Yeah, and then they could go down and take back a bunch of the money that Rick Scott took from Medicare and then used to become governor.
Right, exactly. All right, so they're talking also they're talking basically about to provider.
Right, and there are some ways that, you know, the fact is that health costs are growing faster than the economy is growing. It's not hard for something to grow faster than the economy lately, but even when the economy was booming, health costs were growing faster. So everybody does agree that you do need to slow down the rise of healthcare costs. And one of the things that he proposes sounds kind of reasonable. It tells nursing homes that they need to take care of patients better when they first come back from hospitals, because what you're seeing a lot is that folks will go from a nursing home to a hospital, be treated, come back to the nursing home, and they'll quickly get an infection, or for some other reason they'll quickly wind up back in the hospital. And so what the president's trying to do is encourage nursing homes to be a little bit more diligent about the way they treat people coming back from hospitals, or else pay some type of penalty. You know, so the nursing home would have a little bit of skin in the game, and that might incentivize them to take better care of people coming back from the hospital. And nobody likes to go back and forth from a nursing home to a hospital. So not only would that save money, but it would be better for the person, him or herself.
All right.
Those types of cuts, if they can actually be accomplished, and something needs to be done over the long term. So if they can be accomplished, then bully for them.
And presumably, if Medicare provides, or Medicaid in whichever instance, people wind up in nursing homes often go from Medicare to Medicaid. If Medicare and Medicaid provide the incentive for these nursing homes to increase the quality of their care, it's going to lower the costs across the board for all medical costs, whether they're funded by private insurance or by the public insurance programs.
Right, that's exactly right. And what that would be using the power of single-payer health care to drive down costs, and that's what the left has been saying can be done in healthcare policy for decades. So, you know, Medicaid and Medicare are single payers. So they do have, you know, the power to set policy that ought to, you know, be able to lead to, you know, healthier outcomes at a reduced cost. And you're right, that if they can do that for Medicare and Medicaid patients, it kind of seeps into the rest of the the system and then can reduce costs and hopefully improve outcomes across the board.
All right. So we've talked about the policy. And now, I mean, more or less, we can throw it out. We can throw it out the window, can't we?
Right.
I mean, now that we've had this this conversation about what would happen in a fantasy world, we know that none of this is going to happen, is it?
I don't like to predict the future, but I would be startled if they were able to accomplish this. Boehner yesterday upped his rhetoric and said something like, the federal government spending money is like giving cocaine to a cocaine addict. So if that's the posture that you're taking, it's pretty hard to see where you find middle ground on that. You know, okay, let's just give this guy a little bit of cocaine. I mean, it's such an extreme position on the role of the federal government in society that it's hard to see how anything comes around on this, and the president is now showing that he's got a little bit of spine on entitlements, and he's not going to give up Social Security, and he's not going to give up majorly on Medicare and Medicaid. So that doesn't give Republicans much incentive to come along.
Well, let's talk about this. I mean, is he gotten spine on this, or is this really just a fundamental change in the perspective of what his job is now? In other words, is this a different approach to trying to get this to get some action taken to increase jobs and help the economy, or is it an understanding of like it's not going to happen, and I might as well start the campaign and change my perspective on how I'm going to campaign at this point?
Well, it could be the latter, but if it is, it's about time, because people like yourself have been telling him for years these people are not interested in working with you, and he has continued to try to work with them. So, there was no guarantee that the last debacle was going to finally lead to the epiphany that these folks are not serious. So, if it did, then that's probably a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But my one of my concerns is, I mean, if we look at this just in terms of the politics, and President Obama has taken at least a slight populist turn rhetorically, because he's not in a position to necessarily get this stuff through. I mean, let's put it this way. He could just as easily raise these taxes by doing nothing as proposing this. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, he wouldn't have to do anything except for veto some legislation if it was passed by a Democratic Senate and a Republican House to get the taxes to raise at this point. In fact, it would probably be a larger increase in taxes if he did nothing. So this is, in many respects, it's a political turn. What are the implications of this political turn if he loses? In other words, is the narrative going to be that the reason why he lost the 2012 election, if he loses, and I still think there's a better than even money that he's going to win, frankly, but assuming that he loses, is this become the reason why he lost, because he proposed raising taxes?
You know, to me, narratives aren't really set based on any particular reality anyway. So right. It almost doesn't matter what he does or doesn't do between now and the election in terms of how it affects the narrative. The narrative is going to be set by, competing elite interests about, the story that they want to tell. So I think you're right that some people would try to set the narrative that he went left and he lost. Others would say it was too little too late, he didn't go left far enough, and because he didn't, then there was 9-10% unemployment, and that's why he got wiped out. It's not a perfect analogy, but if you think back to 2010, there were a number of progressive Democrats who were running in kind of swing districts with very populist messages. Alan Grayson, Tom Perriello, Carol Shea Porter, Mary Jo Kilroy, folk John Hall up in New York, folks like that who were saying, you know, we're saying the kinds of things that, that Obama is starting to say now and that progressives have long urged people to say, and they got wiped out. And they got wiped out because the economy overwhelmed them. Now, they have a different bully pulpit than the president does. You know, they're only members of Congress, but they are the people that represent those districts. So, you know, there is some question about how much words even matter if you have this many people out of work.
Right. And so I guess it's I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, 2014 now, almost what becomes the sort of conventional wisdom on the from the Democratic establishment. But I guess it's also we're so far out now, it's almost impossible to tell.
Yeah. And but we're in such a bizarre world, you know, because Obama did some bills that had a lot of pages to them. When when Democrats lost in 2010, the narrative that set was that, oh, Obama was too liberal for the last 2 years, and so he's got to move to the center. And so he moved. He was already in the center, so he moved over to the right, and that's just been, he moved into a buzzsaw. So now he's moving back the other way. But, and, you know, it goes back to what we said earlier, that these narratives aren't set in reality. Nobody who was watching Obama in the first 2 years of his presidency would have said that he was too liberal. You know, Harry Reid was to his left for 2 years. So that, you know, that just tells you where he was on the spectrum.
Right. And of course, we do know that how offensive it is that the Affordable Care Act could actually be over, I think, 100 pages is what the limit is, right? I
mean, right, right.
All right, let me ask you this. So he is essentially asking the super committee to adopt these proposals. He's not introducing legislation. What are the chances that, A, the super committee will provide any will come to a deal? B, what are the chances, if they don't, that the trigger will get essentially repudiated? I mean theoretically, right? The Congress could say, oh, you know that whole deal that we made with the trigger and this and that? We're not going to do that anymore because we don't like $500 billion coming out of defense. So we're just going to change it to, it's, $500 billion out of discretionary and maybe 2% across the board cut for Medicare providers. Could they do that? And do you think that's going to happen?
Well, not only could they do that, I think that that's probably what would happen. I think that's a critical insight that you've got there, that the big lie behind this super committee is that there are going to be these automatic cuts that happen. You know, nothing is automatic in Congress. You know, this is a body that gets together and makes decisions, and there are no cops that are going to tell it what it can and can't do. And so, exactly, when it starts cutting down to the Pentagon bone, they're going to figure out a way to do something else. And what they could do.
Well, wait a second. Let me just stop you there. Bone?
Right.
Past the
toupee.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we're not. I mean, we got a long way to go before we get to the bone in terms of when it comes to defense. But be that as it may,
some Pentagon's people, not fat; it's just big boned.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, so I mean, they could theoretically, that whole thing could be scuttled, and we could just end up with half of that trigger, the half that those of us on the left don't like,
or no trigger. The,
right.
Congress could theoretically increase spending if they wanted to. I mean, or they could kick all of the cuts down to like the 10th year of some imaginary 10-year window. So, they can do anything they want.
And it's all during Christmas anyway, so nobody will be paying attention.
Right, and then the next Congress will come back and can do it right away, or there are all sorts of options.
Well, what is your sense? I mean, you're in Washington. I mean, is that belief starting to take hold? I mean, I know that guys like Graham and I think it was Cornyn were talking about they weren't going to let these defense cuts stand, and I imagine that opens up the door. And frankly, I'm in all in favor, no cutting of anything.
Yeah, right.
But I'm just curious how that's going to play out. And I would imagine that is going to hurt the Republicans. It's going to damage them politically more than it will the Democrats, particularly in the House.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's why the House isn't going to want to admit that this isn't going to happen. But people like you said, Cornyn and Graham, who've been around for a long time, are going to say that. And I'm actually in the process of writing the exact story that you're talking about, saying that this is that this is a big lie, that the mandatory cuts are going to happen. So I think once the media starts talking about it a little more and people start saying, well, wait a minute, are we sure that these cuts are going to happen, then that takes, like you said, a lot of wind out of the super committee's sails.
And so one last thing. There's a story about Boehner apparently is maybe forced to pass the budget. We have an annual budget through an omnibus spending bill. Tell us what that is and why that's bad for Boehner.
So the way that things used to work and the way that Boehner wanted this House to work is he wanted to empower each spending committee to mark up its own spending bill. So, you know, the agricultural committee would go through the subcommittee, there'd be hearings, and then it would then there'd be a markup, then it would go to the full committee and it would be discussed and debated, and then it would be voted on, and then it would be sent to the floor where it would be debated and voted on, and it would all be a very, you know, clean democratic and parliamentary process. That isn't going to happen, it looks like. So he'll have to do an omnibus, which is where you take all of the spending for the government, or almost all of it, and you just dump it into one gigantic bill, the kind that somebody like Boehner would drop on the floor and cry over, and then you pass it in the dead of night with all sorts of tricks and gimmicks and giveaways to try to make sure that you have the 218 votes needed, and it'll look exactly like the process that the Tea Party hates. And so that's why Boehner would like to avoid that type of situation.
And it looks like he's headed to that because he just couldn't get his act together, essentially, to have those different spending bills show up in the House. Is that right?
Yeah, they spent all their time. They spent a lot of time, you know, doing investigations into the president, and then they spent the rest of their time, cutting this, cutting that, passing all sorts of bills. They knew the Senate wouldn't pass a balanced budget amendment. They had their fun, and now the clock is running out, and they're paying for it.
Well, at least we have that scourge of NPR off our backs.
That's right, thankfully.
Oh, thank the Lord. Well, Ryan Grimm, thanks for breaking it down for us. Appreciate your time
thanks
today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I'll get to a couple of stories. Sorry about the phone connection. Seemed a little bit dicey. What are you going to do, folks? Become a member. We'll upgrade the phone system if a lot of you become members. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, more on Troy Davis. Monsanto, don't ask, don't tell. And then the better half of the show a little bit later. We'll be right back. All right, folks, we are back. So, haven't talked about this case, but I guess this morning, or maybe it was yesterday, Tuesday, today, Georgia's Pardons Board rejected clemency for Troy Davis. This is one day before his scheduled execution. He is scheduled to be executed by the state of Georgia. Of course, I know at this point our few conservatives in our audience are now applauding for the execution. I know that Republicans, and I just want to show my respect to Republicans and conservatives everywhere who are now cheering for the execution of this guy. Let me just give you a little background on this story. He was convicted in 1993, I believe, 91. Since 2001, 7 of the 9 witnesses have recanted or contradicted their original testimony. 7 out of 9. Several said they were coerced by the police. There was no physical evidence that was ever produced that Davis killed Mark Allen McPhail. This is a an off-duty Savannah cop who was trying to break up a street fight. He was killed. The gun used in the shooting was never found. And so all of this evidence has come up. Essentially, seven of the nine witnesses have recanted. There was no physical evidence that tied him to this. Our legal system, once you are convicted at a trial on fact, when you appeal it, there is really no opportunity to present new evidence after the case. This is problematic, particularly in murder trials that lead to the execution of people, because we know that since 1973, over 133 men and women have been exonerated or had their death sentences commuted based on post-conviction findings that demonstrate their likely innocence. But that's done by parole boards, or if there's a procedural issue that an appellate court can order a new trial. And just get a sense of the people who have come out, have called for the reopening of his case. Former FBI Director William Sessions, who went as far, apparently last year, 2 years ago, to write an op-ed in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, only a full hearing with all witnesses subject to rigorous cross-examination and a full exploration of the circumstances of their testimony will provide a means to determine the reliability of the conviction. This never happened at Troy Davis's trial. It must happen now. The off-duty cop who was killed is white. Troy Davis is black. There is a slight history, you might say, of black guys in the South not getting, frankly, across the country, not getting fair trials. The Pope, former Libertarian president, presidential candidate Bob Barr, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, are also amongst the people who have called for his trial to be reopened. Ex-Justice Department official Larry Thompson, Jimmy Carter. Now, personally, I don't think anybody should be executed by the state under any circumstances. And no, I would not feel the same if somebody killed my wife or my daughter or my family members. That's why we have laws that should be in place before someone who has been suffered that type of horridness. And I just don't believe in the state sanctioning killing. You don't send a message to society. I mean, never mind the fact that it's been shown. This is even aside from the fact that we've been shown that we've killed innocent people. And never mind the fact that it costs society an extraordinary amount of money. And never mind the fact that it's not effective in terms of deterring crime. All those things aside, philosophically and morally, I'm just against it. I don't think states should have the right to kill people. But I know that position is certainly not dominant in this country. But that's the case. He will be put to death tomorrow by the state of Georgia. And is the Republican debate tonight? I think there's another Republican debate tonight. They'll give him another chance to applaud for that. Good news. We've just killed another person. Apparently, some of the people who have jailed him are convinced that the guy's innocent, too. In terms of good news, however, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was fully repealed last night. saw an amazing video on, I think it was on America Blog or America Blog Gay, and they're not even, and Aravosis, who posts, is not even sure if it's real, but it sure seemed real, where a serviceman basically calls up his dad, guy from Alabama, tells him I'm gay. Not that I'm gay. He doesn't tell him that Sam Cedar's gay. That would be a weird, Dad, I've been listening to this podcast. I just want to out this guy to you. But he tells his father that he is gay. It's pretty touching. And we'll dig that up. We'll put it on majority.fm. And just as the repeal took effect, last night at 12:01, or I guess this morning at 12:01, in Duxbury, Vermont, Navy Lieutenant Gary Ross and his now husband got married. They've been together for 11 years. They decided to marry in Vermont because it was in the Eastern time zone. They wanted to be the first gay couple that includes a military person, I guess, to be married. You know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell started in 1993. The Clinton administration imposed this rule after first trying to allow gay people to serve openly in the military. Pentagon said that 97% of the military has undergone training in the new law. In preparation for the repeal, all branches of the military have spent several months updating regulations. Lifting the ban also brings a halt to all pending investigations, discharges, and other proceedings that have begun under the old law. Existing standards of personal conduct, such as those pertaining to public displays of affection, will continue regardless of sexual orientation. Of course, you understand what this means now. We will all be subject to Sharia law, cats and dogs coming down. Our military is being laughed at by our enemies, and expect the Chinese to invade this country at any moment. Now that we have given gay people the same right to kill and maim other people of other countries in pursuit of such things like oil or resources, or simply an expansion of our military industrial complex. So, have at it, you gays. Kill some people on our behalf. I'm being flip. I don't think that we should not have a military, but I think that ours is far too large and commands far too much of our money. But, folks, it's not just our military that functions to serve as our product ambassadors around the world and to protect our economic interests. So, a story came out at the end of August. And I've just recently seen it. Dozens of United States diplomatic cables released in the latest Wikis dump, this was back in the last week of August, reveal new details of the U.S. effort to push foreign governments to approve genetically engineered crops and promote the worldwide interests of agribusiness giants like Monsanto and DuPont. Do you remember that policy being announced, where we would use the State Department as a cudgel to help Monsanto and DuPont? Diplomatic pressure was placed on Spain and France, with powerful anti-GE crop movements, to speed up their biotech approval process and quell anti-GE sentiment within the European Union. The cables describe biotechnology outreach programs. Some cables, U.S. diplomats asked the State Department for funds to send biotech experts and trade industry representatives to target countries. So we will pay to send Dow and Monsanto representatives. In a 2007 cable, the U.S. Embassy in Paris reported on a meeting among U.S. diplomats and representatives from Monsanto, DuPont, and Dow AgroSciences. The companies were concerned about a movement of French farmers suggested diplomatic angles for speeding up EU approvals of GE crops. Tough regulations and bans on GE crops can deal hefty blows to U.S. exports. 94% of U.S. soybeans, 72% of corn, and 73% of the cotton grown in U.S. now use GE-tolerate herbicides like Monsanto's Roundup. 2007 Cable, for example, reports that the French ban on Monsanto A10 could cost the U.S. $30 million to $50 million in exports. In a 2007 Cable obtained by Truth Out in January, there were threats of moving to retaliate against France for banning Monsanto A10. Can you believe it? These idiots in old Europe, don't they understand that these genetically modified crops are going to lead to a future where you can keep things protected from things like, what are they? Those root worms. It protects corn from root worms. And Tom Philpott in Mother Jones, September 8th, writes, oh, root worms have now developed a resistance to Monsanto's genetically engineered, supposedly bug-killing corn. Scientists have been warning that EPA's rules for planting the crop were too lax to prevent resistance since before the agency approved the crop in 2003. In other words, scientists say that you need to do a 50-50 mix of this corn that kills bugs when they eat it and regular corn so that the bugs don't create and develop a resistance to this genetic structure of the corn that supposedly kills them. Well, scientists in Iowa have documented the existence of corn root worms that can happily devour corn plants that were genetically tweaked to specifically kill them. Monsanto corn now accounts for 65% of the corn planted in the U.S., and now it has created essentially super root worms. This scourge has also arisen in Illinois and Minnesota. Monsanto Company's insect-killing corn is toppling over in northwestern Illinois fields, a sign that rootworms outside of Iowa may have developed a resistance to the genetically modified crop, reports Bloomberg. Our BT corn is effective, said Monsanto scientist Dusty Post. We don't have any demonstrated field resistance.
Dusty Post.
But back in 2008, a study conducted by the University of Missouri and published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science on this precise question of BT corn and rootworms found that within three generations, rootworms munching on Monsanto's BT corn survived at the same rate as rootworms munching on pesticide-free corn. In other words, built-in obsolescence. Bought our corn then, now buy our new improved corn. Really guaranteed to kill rootworms for a couple of years when you'll have to buy our new updated new Monsanto corn. I would not be surprised if this wasn't part of their business plan. If there wasn't some, PowerPoint. And this is the way we'll make money for the rest of our lives, guys. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to go to the better half of the show. And when we do, I will welcome to the program Lee Stranahan, guy who's on my Twitter feed, who made some very good videos, anti-McCain videos back in the day, but has since been working for Breitbart. And his tweets just drive me crazy, and I will tell you and him why when we come back, which will happen shortly. All right, we'll be right back after this.